Okay, great. So, welcome to another episode of the Berkland Insights podcast. This week we have with us Mark Zablatsky. Mark is a Berkland CFO. He's one of our consulting CFOs, and he also heads up our rest of US practice. Berkland is concentrated at this point heavily in the Bay Area and San Francisco and in the New York Boston corridor. And Mark helps startups sort of in between those two places and north of south, or mostly south of the one on the East Coast. And everything in the middle. So Mark, thanks a lot for joining us. You know, one of the things we're trying to do with this series is help communicate to startup founders and to, you know, CEOs of smaller firms, venture-backed businesses that we work with at Berkland, sort of what we've dealt with as veterans of prior crises and some of the plays that we either saw utilized or utilized ourselves back the last time there was a major crisis, hopefully to help the folks that are trying to deal with the economic dislocation of the COVID-19 crisis. So looking back in the day, you know, what was the crisis that you remember the most vividly from your business career? And just sort of help us set the stage a little about where were you? What was the crisis? What was the business doing? And what were the impacts of that crisis on what you guys were up to?
We're talking about 2007, 2008, and even a little 2009. I was running a startup at the time that was in the travel business. I worked with hotels and airlines. We did something was called dynamic packaging. It's like the back end for hotel reservation systems to help them connect airlines and activities. This is all pre, you know, this is early days of kind of internet travel.
Web-based travel, right?
I mean, we would combine the things and drive traffic to the hotel site so that they didn't go to the Expedia and the Orbitzes that were kind of eating the big hotels' lunch at the time. But capital dried up, new business opportunities dried up, and the business shut down, even though we had done a proof of concept that we could drive value to our customers. It was just not a good time for
Right.
new things to happen. And our primary investor decided it was better to pull the plug than put in additional capital at that time. He retrenched his core business and focused on parts of the economy that were being positively impacted, as opposed to, you know, travel and entertainment, which is kind of always on that cutting edge of, you know, when workers are impacted most, consumer spending goes down. You know, though there are areas of the country's economy that get hit the hardest, and it's
And
usually
he so he
consumer.
reallocated basically and took the legs out from underneath what you guys were doing.
Yeah.
So this was the 07, 08, 09 financial crisis. I was running a company back then as well, and there were a lot of, you know, gnashing of teeth and hand-wringing at the time. But what stands out to you when you compare where we are now and where business CEOs and CFOs kind of things that they're dealing with now compared to then?
I mean, yeah. And so in that crisis, you know, the GDP fell 4.3% and unemployment reached 10%. And that was
Right.
over like an 18-month recession
And we were
in a
freaking out,
matter of
right?
months. Yeah. And we were
Exactly.
freaking out then.
Right.
And now, you know, unemployment is up to 20% and GDP was down almost 5% in the month of April. You know, we're seeing, and things just don't come back quickly because jobs get lost a lot quicker than they come back. You
Right.
know, people are forecasting up to like a 20% decline in GDP this year. So the scale is just very different, but the effects are very different because, well, actually, the parts of the economy that are affected are, there's some similarities, but there's also a lot of things that are different this time around. And I think the worker is impacted so much more this time around, whereas last time around, you know, it was big companies that were most impacted, and then in return, their workers. But here, it's the
Right.
workers even
Right.
more.
How do you think CEOs and their businesses and their investors and everybody involved in that ecosystem should index that? I mean, there's this sense in some of the people that I talk to that, you know, a vaccine comes out tomorrow, all those millions of people are right back to work again. And kind of like, we all kind of go, oh, that's just terrible. And we kind of pick up where we left off again. We don't have as much of a slog out of it potentially. What are your thoughts around that stuff?
I mean, I'd like to think that way, but I just from experience, you know, companies retrench and so the jobs don't come back as quick.
Right.
And a lot of companies go out of business and those jobs eventually come back, but they have to find new homes. So
right.
There's no, from my perspective, you know, we're at 20% unemployment, right? Roughly. But we, you know, it's not going back down to the threes and the fours anytime soon. It's going to take a long time.
To dig out.
There's some positives. There's some opportunities to come out of this too.
So when you're looking at it then, so, okay, we'll assume that this is a longer slog. And if the scale is any indicator, it may be even a longer slog than a cyclical type of recovery would suggest. Beyond the kind of knee-jerk reaction of we have to save cash, you know, Berkeley's done a lot of work on contingency planning. We've advised a lot of our clients around the ways to think at the world a little differently in terms of AR and all that. But what do CEOs and their management teams do, right? Like, what beyond the easy stuff of like, oh, don't pay your rent until you have to, what other aspects of managing through a storm did you learn?
Yeah. So I'm in my 50s. So I've gone through a few of these crises. It wasn't just that one crisis. Mm-hmm. And what I've learned and what I recommend primarily, it starts with your customers. You want to make your existing customers as happy as possible. They're your core business. You don't want, it's more expensive to find new customers than to, you know, actually it's more expensive to lose customers than trying to slowly grow new customers. So I focus on my existing customers, make them happy, try to expand within the existing customer base, because though they're more likely to do new programs with you than a company you've never worked with before. It's also, you don't need as many salespeople to do that. And so my number one recommendation is focusing on your existing customers. And then
right, so kind of an extension base, on right? that.
Yeah. So make sure, secure the base and then expand from the base. And so as opposed to sales efforts, like on new clients, you know, get referrals from existing happy customers, but focus more time and energy were on kind of client referrals to people they know. And you know, so that's one thing. And I actually think if you're not currently doing Net Promoter Score, you should do it. It's one of the things we recommend, and it's easy to do. And they would be at the top of my list if I was not doing it. And then usage metrics that may have not been getting as much attention about how much people are using the product, how much more time they're spending on it or less time or expansion of users in an existing customer. I think that becomes a high priority. You know, obviously we're always thinking about churn, and we should be thinking about churn as well, but we should be looking at churn from the perspective of why did I lose these customers and addressing right. that instead of just I'm losing customers and I'll get new customers, and figuring out ways and spending time to actually re-engage with customers that may have churned and actually mm-hmm. doing exit interviews that you may have said you were going to do and stop doing because you were focused on new customers. Sometimes that customer that churns could become a great customer in the future if you figure out what it was that was going wrong, because they decided to use your product for a reason. Mm-hmm. And obviously you weren't meeting their needs. I don't know. Do you have any things that you strategically focus on for customer retention?
Well, in my background, I mean, there's a couple times where we were faced with a pretty steep drop-off, crisis-driven drop-off in customers. And one of the things that we did very tactically would be to reach out and try to cross-sell them from one thing into the other. Maybe we weren't, like you were saying, we were focusing on certain products and not really the others. And if we started feeling something slip, we would immediately try to understand, like you said, are they just leaving because of the crisis, or are there other issues that foot here? One other thing we did was automatically have a pricing conversation with them. Our customers were all hedge funds back then. So, you know, if they were up against the wall as well and they were gated and all that, we would work out pretty creative pricing mechanisms to keep them as a customer. and hold them, even if it meant we reduced a little bit of revenue, or in some cases we reduced a major portion of it, but we kept the customer. And that, back to that, live to fight another day, we retained them, and we did it with the understanding that when all this is said and done, and the hedge fund is ungated, and maybe there's more latitude there, we would revert right back to pre-crisis pricing. But that was one thing that we did very, very quickly. It was a little easier because these were all enterprise customers. You know, we could fit all of our company's customers in a ballroom, right? So it was easy for me to reach out to everybody and have very one-on-one conversations. I imagine that's harder if it's like a big SaaS business with millions of customers. But I still think price is a quick thing to do. Forget your margins, right? Like all your stuff about, oh, well, we're going to lose money. Yeah, you know what? You'd rather get 50 instead of 100 versus getting zero instead of 100.
Another thing that comes to mind is it's time to put in a new sales incentive program. You cannot leave the existing incentives in that you currently have.
Good point.
You need to redo the program so that it focuses on the things that you want them focusing on. And if retention is now a key driver, then you know the sales team can be incentivized by renewals as opposed to just new sales. And it's time to really rethink what quota is and, you know, what makes up a quota. And, you know, you may still keep that original quota to measure against, but you need to come up with a new objective or a new quota for
new baselines almost, right? Because it is a new environment.
Yeah, you know, people that wait too long to change their incentives, you got a whole disgruntled and disorganized and sales team that doesn't know what they should be focusing on.
You know, riffing on that a little bit even further, the same could be said for employees, right? So you may have to do salary cuts and you may have to really ask a lot of your people while they're working for less. So if you haven't got a good equity plan in place and you need everybody to kind of believe in the longer term haul, putting in things like RSUs or looking at your cap table in tandem with your investors to see what could you offer folks in lieu of cash.
I also, you know, I hate when I'm recommending to kind of downsize, but I think it's a good time to retrench your sales team and focus on your top performers. Just like your existing customers, you want to make them happy, make your top performing salespeople happy. You know, weed out the ones that aren't performing as well, because it's going to be a lot harder to make new sales. And, you know, get those top performers committed to the long term, because they're going to be attractive and they're going to be headhunted by other companies as well.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, do you also, like you had mentioned in your first client, or your first crisis rather, not your first one necessarily, but your experience in the 2009 crisis, your investor kind of like said, I'm going to go in a different direction. Do you also shore up relationships with your investors while you can in this crisis?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, during another crisis, I was running a company that was out raising money. We were trying to raise money or sell our company to a PE firm. We were at a signed LOI. We were moving into due diligence, and then that just disappeared and dried up. And then we got some other private equity offers, but the board, you know, wouldn't even consider them because the valuation was so much lower than what we were going through due diligence at the time. And we ended up raising money from our existing investors instead. They decided that they had wanted to flip. It was time for them to get out, but they decided to re-up and reinvest and stay in. And so we focused on our existing investors because the other money dried up.
Mm-hmm. And I learned when I was doing this in that same era that things you don't necessarily think you have to worry about, you actually do need to worry about. Like you were saying, your salespeople, you have to keep them motivated. You have to accentuate positive stuff. You have to find silver linings where you can. Because it is pretty scary out there if you're just an employee, and making sure the motivational stuff that you're able to do is still not, you know, it doesn't become a priority, but it certainly becomes maybe more visible. Like people are watching very carefully. The rumor mill, right, can really start to spool up, sometimes with good reason. Do you see a parallel in the 2009 crisis where there's more than just what's happening at the company that's impacting people who work at a firm. And so CEOs have to worry about the bigger picture, not just the actual company themselves, but in other aspects of employee lives. I don't know if my question is clear or not, but like when I was dealing with it, people's homes were being foreclosed on at the same time they're worried about their job, right? And I think there's a parallel today to that.
So if you're a CEO or founder that's a good relationship person and with your, you know, with your team and like they're like your family, you know, this will be easy because you'll just naturally do it. If you're, you know, a hard driving CEO, which is all about growth and, you know, let's hit our targets and, you know, like we're going to be a unicorn, you know, you've got to rethink some of your priorities and focus on your employees and try to build relationships and keep your team in place because the team, your A performers can leave very easily.
Right. And as the world starts to unlock a little bit, that's going to be a question of whether or not you keep some of that key talent or whether they go to other places that might be looking for that kind of growth. I mean, that's a good segue into another thing I wanted to talk about, which is what in those prior crises, and you have a couple examples maybe of where you saw an opportunity or where you experienced a company moving and pivoting toward an area of opportunity in the midst of, you know, a really existential crisis.
In the last crisis, I all of a sudden was unemployed or underemployed, right? And became a kind of a startup guy. I mean, I was doing a bunch of startups. I was doing somewhere I got paid, somewhere I was getting equity, somewhere I was just trying to get things off the ground. And what I did see, and the opportunity here again, is there are a lot of entrepreneurial and new and startups that come out of crises like this. The people that weren't entrepreneurs or were fully employed and didn't have the time, a lot of new ideas and a lot of new companies come out of a crisis.
Out of the disruption, sure.
I mean, if it's actually, it's pretty amazing some of the huge companies that came out of the last crisis.
Yeah.
And they were Groupon and Venmo and Uber and WhatsApp and Slack. All were kind of 2007, 2008, early 2009 companies that just, you know, exploded. And a lot of them are financial oriented or the gig economy, you know, actually the gig economy started out of the last recession because all of a sudden there was a lot of these people that were partially employed, underemployed, or, you know, and they needed ways to make money.
To make money.
On the side. I mean, that all started in the last recession.
You know, and that's totally true. And one of the things that I've seen in every crisis I've been through and the one we're in right now is where very enterprising CEOs look at the business skill set that their company has and then look out into the wide world, into the crisis, and ask themselves, what's working? Like, what's now, what has shifted in what we do where we could take what we've got and redeploy it in a different way or reimagine maybe our products? Or like you said at the beginning of the podcast, reach out to their core customers and ask them, like, what do you guys need now? What can we do to provide you with something you might need? And sometimes it's surprising what they hear back and they're able to turn and pivot. We had a firm where in the last crisis in 2007, 2008, 2009, where, you know, it turned out that with a few minor tweaks, we were able to reposition a product, which actually was kind of a backwater for us, but through the sort of guidance and suggestions of a couple of our key customers, we were able to actually turn that into a major winner for the firm. And it didn't end up being a long-term serious leg of the stool, but it certainly generated enough revenue for the company to live to fight another day, which I think was a key thing at the time. I think that's another element too. I mean, like, what do you think of mentality? I know in my own case, we shifted from that growth at all costs to please the investor mentality to a live to fight another day mentality. And I think there's something valuable there, lesson wise, about how to shift your perspective as a CEO. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, so I think my biggest concern here in the Bay Area is you've got a lot of young entrepreneurs that have never been through a crisis before. So this is the first, like, they're used to growth. There never being a recession, you know, especially here, you know, in the Bay Area. And so the mentality in a crisis versus the mentality in a growing economy is very, very different. The multiples, what people are willing to pay for your company are going to go down. Growth trajectory is not going to be what you're used to. So you need to shift the goalposts and shift your priorities and kind of decide what your new objectives are, because that budget that was approved in 2019 for 2020 is most likely not going to happen.
It's out the window. Yeah.
And if you are thinking about doing a raise the end of this year, you pretty much got to be thinking it's not going to happen until the following year. So push everything out at least 12 months, because you want to be raising in a better economy or be thinking about bridge funding that kind of pushes off that issue until later, that, you know, the next round.
Yeah, and I know there's a lot of reticence amongst venture-backed startups to take debt, but in terms of what might be the right play, CEOs, I think, should be looking at venture debt and even like this Main Street lending program that they're trying to put together with the Federal Reserve, because that could be great and very inexpensive bridge financing, like you just said, to your next equity round, because the world is a different place now, at least for a little while. It's going to stay kind of in unsettled territory from an equity raise, you know, equity capital perspective. We were looking at some statistics the other day about how after the 2009 crisis, for another 18 months, almost every round that was done was an insider round. So you're not going to get new capital. You might get capital from your old investors, but new guys are going to be tough to find.
I mean, yeah, I think the mantra is secure your base, and that base includes your customers, your employees, and your investors. And all the great pie in the sky things you were thinking about, you know, they'll come back. They can still happen, but that's not the priority now.
Right. The old, was it triple, triple, double, three, triple again for SaaS businesses or something like that, right? There's a mantra there, and that's just gone for now. Like, don't cry about it. It is what it is. And let's just now reestablish the base, like you just said. Where did you see people miss? Like, what mistakes did you see? Where did you see guys doing things that, looking back on it in hindsight, if you had it to do over again, you might have done it differently or suggested it be done differently?
Companies that think it's going to come back really quick and don't make the hard decisions and retrench. The hard decisions, the worst decisions, the laying people off that you don't want to lay off, the bringing expectations in-house, lowering, salaries flat and reduce. I mean, you can't burn at the same rate you've been burning. I mean, two of my companies are both essentially cutting their burn in half. Okay. Both of them completely different clients, completely different customers, and they're both trying to cut their burn in half from what was their original budget.
Yeah. I mean, I think we talked about this a little bit earlier. We touched on this. Things drop faster than they go up, right? So about part of that retrenchment, we were talking about how quickly do things recover. I think CEOs listening to this, you guys should understand that kind of retrenchment, like you were just saying, Mark, with a 50% lower burn, you might find you're actually able to do the same thing you were doing before, or at least close. So you realize the efficiencies that can get gained. And this is one of the reasons why those jobs don't just come flooding back, because all of these companies have trimmed their burn down and are able to survive. They may not be quite as quick to rush and replace that burn, because they've understood that they were carrying a little bit higher expense levels than they really needed to. For me, it was a very eye-opening experience to realize that I could actually run the business and do what we needed to do with 75% of the cost that I had before. Right.
Well, another thing is that a lot of burn is driven by VCs wanting companies to scale quickly, hire, 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 increase your sales team, increase your marketing team. The VCs are not saying that now.
Right.
And so even though you may have increased your burn because your VC may have pushed you to hire and scale quicker, you may need to go back to what you were doing before. And then grow, you know, you're still going to grow. You're still, you know, you still have a long-term potential of success, but it's just, you're kind of go back into a holding pattern, or, you know, go back one step.
My case, I also remember very much the speed thing you just mentioned before. Like, it's easy to kind of almost be a spectator and not drive. You're kind of watching things happen. I remember when like Lehman failed, Remember that one October, Lehman failed, Citi failed, I believe Wachovia. I mean, they all like AIG, remember, like boom, boom, boom. And I remember just thinking like, this is crazy. It was like watching a movie. And recognizing after the fact that steering the business was valuable, like speed. Even if you overdid it, maybe you made decisions without all of the information, but moving quickly was such a valuable trait to have put in. Do you see startups making that mistake again? I know I do. Like they're just not moving fast enough. And this one is at an order of magnitude that's even bigger than what we saw before.
Actually, so the companies I'm working with are moving quickly to course correct. You know, when you're growing quickly, a lot of mistakes and warts and holes in your business are covered up because sales cure everything. And
right.
Once sales get flat, all of a sudden you're measuring things more, even more, and your story and your metrics and things become even more important. And, you know, you start looking at how much are people using your product in your existing customers before mm-hmm. you barely even cared about that, right?
Right.
And so the kind of, you know, just like we talked about retrenching, I mean, you've got to focus on the problems. Whereas before you kind of, the problems, oh, we'll eventually work that out because we're growing and it's all about customer acquisition. Well,
right.
It's not.
Once we have a million users, we'll figure all that out.
Exactly. Yeah. So you can no longer kind of push that product or customer or debt out. You got to deal with it now. You know, since we're kind of brainstorming here, now's a good time to do a new 409A.
Yep. Good point. Yep.
You know, if your stock is overvalued to your employees, it's time to reset the bar and lower it. I just did that with one of my clients. They did an inside round and we went and did our 409A. We were expecting maybe to be down 3-5% off the last, you know, the last round. And we ended up reduced. This is a successful company. This is a company mm-hmm. that actually is growing. And our 409 went down like 37% from the last
wow.
round. Because
wow.
the risk, it was, you know, even though we were growing, the risk and the fact that it was an inside round with, you know, yes, it was up, but it wasn't up as much and the runway wasn't as long as they had in the last, you know, when they had done the 409A like 6 months before, the price went down 37%. So that's
a really good point. I hadn't thought of that.
Then you can, and then, you know, maybe it's time to relook at everybody's stock options and reset it. Like if people mm-hmm. have underwater options, you know what? Tear them up and
toss them out. Yep.
Toss them out and start handing them out again. You've got a pool. As a founder, you can do whatever you want with that pool. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of leverage, leeway with that. Hopefully, you know, 10% or more of the company, you know, put it to use.
That's 100% correct. Another thing I think that is valuable for folks to be thinking about here, and I'm curious what your thoughts are on it, is, you know, the old saying about buy when there's blood in the streets, right? For companies that have the wherewithal and the backing, this is also a time where opportunistic acquisitions or JVs reaching out, you can expand your client base and your customer base sometimes pretty easily and pretty cheaply relative to what it might have cost you, say, a year ago by, if you have that wherewithal, by using, I mean, it sounds awful, but, you know, using the downturn as a way to expand your footprint through acquisitions acqui-hires.
That was on my list of things that I saw the last time around, which is the companies that had cash, it was a good time to buy their weaker competitors. So, you know, buy customers. You know, they're basically, this is the time when things are valued at a low. Kind of flowing off of that, there's another thing that founders need to be honest with themselves. Do I have a business or do I have a product? Okay.
Yeah.
And if you're a solution that is in search of customers, but could be valued by someone already going to those customers with a more broad product line,
something else,
that was mm-hmm. probably the time to kind of roll it into another company so that you don't get bought up at the end of the crisis. If you have a product that people could leverage better than you are because you don't have the existing relationships, the existing customers, now is actually a good time to do those strategic selling of the company or strategic partnerships.
Yeah. And when I was doing this, I realized that, you know, they'll take that call. now because of the crisis. The crisis kind of throws out a lot of those presupposed things. Oh, I would never call those guys. They're our big, and that, well, you know what? They'll call you and you should call them and have those conversations. And I think the access of those avenues is a lot higher when the walls are burning than in a normal environment. I liked what you said just now about founders need to be honest with themselves. Hey, boy, there's a lot wrapped up in that. And when the shooting starts, everybody needs to look in the mirror a little bit and understand what they're good at and what they're not.
Yeah. Now, so, at the same time, being honest with yourself is having the hard conversations with your VC. Because to be honest, they know who you could work best with or partner with or be sold to, because they're investing in similar and related companies. Now's actually a time to work closely with other portfolio companies if there's an opportunity to help each other.
Good point.
So the value of the VC may change. It may not just be about money. It may be about customers, portfolio companies, acquisition, who could I sell myself to? You just need to be thinking.
All of those things are on the table, right? All right. Well, this has been great. Thank you so much for sharing your background and your experience with us. I think more than ever, probably younger CEOs and startup leaders who were 12 years into an expansion and never really been shot at like this before. Not like anybody's ever really been shot at like this before, but shot at, period. I think everyone is looking for nuggets and tidbits of how do I navigate this? So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us, and I'll leave it there unless you have any parting pearls you'd like to.
I've actually enjoyed this conversation. It made me think back and then think forward, and a couple ideas came out that I hadn't thought about prior to this conversation. So thank you.
Look at that. All right, great. That's it. We're wrapping up another episode of the Berkeley Insights podcast, and we look forward to talking to you next time. Thanks.